Hello, welcome to Unofficial Partner, the sports business podcast. I'm Richard Gillis. This podcast is a conversation about the commercial questions hanging over women's sport. It was organised by Lisa Parfitt, the managing director of Engine Sport, who helped us pull together two great guests, England cricketer Georgia Elwes and former Chelsea and England footballer Claire Rafferty. Georgia Elwes is a right-arm medium-fast bowler and right-handed batsman who first played for the England team in South Africa in 2011 and was a member of the one-day side that won the ICC Women's World Cup on that great day at Lord's in 2017. Claire Rafferty played for Millwall, Chelsea and West Ham in the Women's Super League and made her full international debut against Austria in 2010. Was a member of the Team GB side at London 2012 and played for England in the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup. For more details on Engine Sport's work in women's sport, go to their website where you can watch the webinar that preceded this podcast.
The fact that we were treated as equal for the first time, the label of a women's footballer was removed from us and we were then Team GB. And I think for the first time, we had almost like an unconditional love that we had never experienced.
The Unofficial Partner podcast is now published daily, and we're proud and grateful that our conversations are being listened to by thousands of people from across the sports business every week of the year. If you'd like to inquire about advertising, sponsorship or branded podcasts, please get in touch with Sean via sean@unofficialpartner.co.uk, or you can reach us via the website unofficialpartner.com. Lisa, can you just sort of give us the picture from where you are? Because we've heard a lot, and there's a lot of people saying that this is a new dawn for women's sport, and we're all standing there thinking, yes, okay, you particularly, but also lots of other people have been saying that for a long time that there is real commercial value in women's sport. Mm-hmm. Can you just sort of draw a picture? How real is this new dawn, and where are we in the sort of evolution of this story, and mm-hmm. where do we need to get to?
Very real, I would say. If I was to answer that, you know, straight back at you, very real. I think, and there's real evidence to that. The new dawn, as we're talking about. I think FIFA released, you know, a billion views of the Women's World Cup last year. We've seen record after record after record being broken in the UK in terms of viewing of women's football. In particular, you're seeing huge growth of participation as well, because it's often easy to look at one particular part of women's sport, whether that's visibility or whether that's broadcast numbers, but you're seeing huge growth in terms of participation of girls playing football, of girls playing cricket, of girls playing netball. And you're also seeing sports now providing, the professional career path for women to be able to play those sports as a career. So, you know, it's very real. And I think the stage that we're at now is, it feels like we're kind of pushing beyond normalization now. But we're definitely still in that phase whereby, you know, it needs to be normal for boys and girls, men and women, to see girls playing sport and being active. And I mean that, you know, all the way through, and not just in the sports perhaps you would typically or stereotypically expect them to play in, you know, perhaps tennis and netball, you know, all sports. I think that's the stage that we're at now, is that normalization. From a commercial perspective, you know, there are metrics that frankly are a little outdated now in terms of the commercial investment and the media coverage. Whilst they are still low when you compare it to men's sport, they are increasing. You know, the number of brands that are now involved with netball, so the Vitality Roses, with football, the Barclays Super League, you know, numbers and lots of brands investing significant sums and then committing themselves to ensure that they're, you know, paying their athletes equally, giving the same bonuses to their athletes as well. So, you know, like, it's actually really hard to even summarize the moments and the changes that we've had over the last year. But for me, I think a real litmus test is the number of young girls that you're starting to see picking up and playing the sports, which is why it's been so important and fundamental for all the governing bodies to have their participation programs in place, because ultimately that's where it starts. That's why the FA made a what if pledge for women in football to get women's football or girls football into every single school in this country, because that is fundamentally where you're going to start a behavior rather than change a behavior, which is much harder, but start a behavior early on in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, Claire, I'm going to push that to you, because the London 2012 Olympics felt like a moment. Signals are important in this debate, and London 2012, we came out the back of it with this incredible cast of women athletes, and you know, you were there in amongst that. And then if you scroll forward from there to where we are today, you're looking at World Cups with, as Lisa said, there were just enormous numbers and interest, and it seems obvious. But from your perspective on the athlete side, what did it look like at London 2012?
You know what? London 2012 was probably one of my fondest memories. And I think ultimately, you know, not just because of the, you know, the athlete's village, but also because of the fact that we were treated as equal for the first time. The label of a women's footballer was removed from us, and we were then Team GB. And I think for the first time, we had almost like an unconditional love that we had never experienced. And I think, you know, we had, you know, sell out at Wembley where we played against Brazil, 80,000 people coming, which was just unheard of. So that experience in itself changed the players, and it almost was a kind of a shining light as to where the game could go and what are we doing wrong here. You know, it just highlighted the label that is attached to women's sport, because as soon as it was removed, everyone, you know, was willing to get behind the team. So I think for me that was massive. And then moving forward, I think it actually gave people the opportunity to judge for themselves about the standard of the women's football. And so, you know, we had a fan base off the back of that. I think the 2000, it was the Euros came next, and then the 2015 World Cup. So I think each of these tournaments, you know, we've seen a huge increase in televised games, and obviously BBC playing them. So I think that kind of media exposure goes hand in hand with the fact that people are actually having a little bit more accessibility towards the games.
Well, one of the features on the media question is, you know, that we've seen the Telegraph particularly, you know, come forward with a special, you know, a sort of a real focus on women's sport. How have the questions changed? What do people want? Has that altered over that period of time? The questions that journalists want to know.
Yeah, I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because when we, you know, talk about, and I can only really talk about football, but I think we've always been a lot more approachable than male footballers, and I think that's been our selling point. And I think, as you're saying, the Telegraph and other media outlets, you know, they've really been a force for change and pushing, you know, equal representation in the papers and in the outlets. And I think without that, as I was saying before, everything has to work together, and we all need to be taking these steps forward at the same time. So I think they have to do their bit, and they have improved and increased exposure. And I think, you know, that when we come back to, you know, my line of work at the moment, which is commercializing the, you know, the women's game, I think that it's important to have representation, because otherwise it's very difficult to sell to brands, because a lot of brands just want media buyers, and I think that's where everyone has to play their part.
Georgia, let's bring you in to this conversation. Just on the because cricket is in a really interesting place. And obviously we're not, I'm not going to talk about the 100 this summer, and we're fingers crossed that it's going to happen or when it's going to happen. But there was a statement about equal prize money. What did that mean to the players?
Yeah, I think it was massive. I think it's something that's really symbolic. And I think it shows how valued the women are compared to the men in this competition. I think alongside that, the prize fund's 600,000 and it's going to be split 300,000 each. So that's massive. But alongside that, the ECB are committing to the same player treatment on and off the field as well, in terms of, you know, accommodation, flights for the overseas players and all sorts of things like that. So I think with all of that wrapped up together, it really shows how much the female players are valued by the ECB, which is massive.
What's the conversation at the moment in the dressing rooms and, you know, around cricket? Has that altered in terms of the view? Because from the outside, obviously, people like me, you look at there's a certain amount of symbolism and signals being sent, and there are messages being sent. But what's it like? What's the conversation inside the dressing room?
I think it's really difficult, because inside the dressing room, you're just a player who is doing what they love and is playing for their country and a sport they love. And sometimes things like that aren't really spoken about, because, you know, you're just trying to concentrate on what you're doing. But then I suppose when you have a little bit of time, like we're having at the moment, to just sit back and reflect, I think the statement that the ECB are making with that prize money is massive. I think the long-term commitment that the ECB are showing to the women's game at the moment is massive in these 8 regional centres that are being set up as well for the competition, which is starting in September, and that, you know, that long-term financial support into growing the women's game, I think is really significant. And I think sometimes as players you just sort of play, and it's not until you take a step back or you have a little bit of time off that you can really reflect on that.
Claire mentioned that I've pushed people to answering questions about big moments, big events, whether it's the World Cup final at Lords or whether it's the FIFA moments or the Olympics. I guess there is also this desperate need for the sort of day-to-day narrative to be maintained. Mm. Lisa, what's in terms of the how rights holders do that and the appetite from the commercial side to support that? What do you see there?
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think I was asked at the end of last year, you know, I was doing one of those kind of wrap-ups of the year and, you know, what an incredible year it had been. Actually, you get to the end of the year and you've forgotten how much, you know, we'd really had. Ashes and Vitality Never World Cups and the FIFA World Cup. You know, there's so much that happened last year. And I asked the question, you know, what was your hope for next year? And my hope, not knowing what was going to happen, but my hope for this year was that you would see the day-to-day stories, the kind of constant drip feed of, you know, visibility of women's sport. And as you said, rather than necessarily focus on those big global moments, I think we can do those big global moments now. You know, women's sport has progressed at an elite level, admittedly not everywhere around the world. And, you know, the World Cup showed that to a certain extent, but, you know, we capture the attention, and sport, as we know, can capture the attention on a global scale when we're supporting our national athletes. And my hope was absolutely that the day in, day out, so the likes of the Barclays Super Women's Super League, you know, that we would start to see people following those teams and supporting those teams. We would start to see the stories of, you know, Dina Asher-Smith and, you know, her Team GB compatriots come to the fore. And I think you are starting to see that, because actually what you're starting to see are the likes of the Daily Telegraph, who have made a significant commitment to provide, you know, greater level of coverage of women's sport. And what that means is, you know, and requires a dedicated team of people who are following women's sport and the various different games. So you're starting to get diversity of sport and stories and women who are runners who are taking part in long distance running whilst at the same time breastfeeding their children. You know, I just think the journalism as a result is better, is more interesting. And again, it actually gives a bit of kind of more sense of kind of real life and real behind the scenes of women's sport and a bit of a reality of it. You know, sometimes it is difficult for young children and girls to imagine themselves on a global stage playing at a World Cup. But, you know, could they imagine themselves in the Super League? Absolutely. There's no reason. I think, you know, having that diversity of story, you know, gives a bit more of a kind of an attainable opportunity. And those stories, you know, provide great creativity and gives us another great angle and insight into sport. So, the commitment that you're starting to see with the coverage is certainly really helping that kind of constant drip feed of stories.
I'm wondering from Claire and George's perspective. Claire, if I come from to you first of all, there is a obviously the shift generally, stepping back for a moment, from pure linear television coverage, broadcast coverage, to digital channels, social media becoming a much bigger sort of platform. How do you think that players should engage with that? There is an opportunity here for them to build personal brands, and that's important from a commercial perspective.
Yeah, as I was saying before, I think women's football is naturally, because it's always been a free media outlet, has utilised that more so than potentially the male football. But I think actually, you know, at the beginning of the WSL, we had our Twitter handles on our sleeves of our shirts. So I think the initiative was always there to use the platform and create a brand that way. But I think now it's shifted towards obviously the OTT platforms, the FA Player showing most, if not all, of the games. But I still think actual content from clubs is kind of paramount to keep the audience engaged. I think I know at Chelsea our aim for the women's side is to be the most followed on social media. So it sounds quite like a fresh statement, but I think Barcelona are at the top at the moment and Chelsea are second. So I think if you can fight the battle that way, and I think speaking in men's terms, I don't think it's that as important. So I think that highlights how key that is. And I think going back to just individual brands, they're all role models. You have to be conscious of what you're doing and how you carry yourself in the media. So I think it is important and it still needs to increase and improve. And I think organically as well, it can't be too forced.
Georgia, sort of same question to you, really. What is there if I sort of twist the question slightly, I mean, I'm looking here at the athlete, you know, the cricketers themselves building their own sort of levels of fame and engagement. I was talking to Seb, who runs Hashtag United, and his view was that sports people should focus on sport. It's really hard to juggle both of these things, because actually being an influencer takes a lot of time and effort, and that obviously there's an opportunity cost of you should be practicing and doing cricket stuff. What's your take? How do you balance those two?
Yeah, I think it's really individual. I think there's a lot of girls in our team who have got the personality which is suited to, you know, putting every second of their life on social media, and they love it and they love the engagement that they get from that. And then there are other girls who like to just quietly go about their business and are not so, I suppose, involved on social media. But I think it's really individual. I think I suppose the more you put out there, the more engagement you're going to get. As long as
is there an encouragement from the teams or from the board themselves to get out there?
Yeah, I think our media manager's really he's quite laid back in, you know, not pushing us to do anything. He provides a lot of content for us, which is brilliant. And it's really then up to us what we put out there. I think we're quite conscious that around big tournaments and big events, there's a lot of content. And then when we're on downtime, there's probably not a lot of content. So it might be that you know, players can focus on providing, I guess, the same level or the same amount of content all year round, rather than having these big peaks just at tournaments. And I know that's something I'm guilty of myself. It's quite easy when you're away and you're on your phones quite a lot to put that content out there. But yes, maybe there is a an onus on us to be putting out, you know, what we're doing, and I guess, yeah, expressing ourselves online. But I do think it really depends on the personality of the player, and it's really up to them.
Lisa, you mentioned earlier, you said that there were some outdated models in terms of you know, looking at this from a commercial perspective. What are sponsors looking for now? I mean, this shift towards digital, social, the rise of the athlete, all of these things, but are they still coming with it needs to have a big broadcast number attached?
No, not all of them. And those that do, you know, it's not necessarily the right opportunity, I think, you know, for women's sport, and also not treating that as one big one platform, you know, the homogenous group of sports. You know, you've got to look at them all individually. And those that are looking for that, then you know you've got to look in different places. If it is just going to be about, you know, the media from LEDs, you know, the reality is that there, you know, perhaps other than, you know, Premier League, there are very few sports, men and women's, that provide back page and front page, you know, newspaper coverage week in, week out. It's actually pretty difficult to find something like that without spending, you know, a huge amount of money. So we're finding, no, that's not the case. And the reality is you know, you can start to incorporate, you know, media buy and media strategies within any sponsorship campaign, activation campaign. But I mean, even however many years ago it was, and it seems like quite, you know, a long time ago when we did the SSE deal with the Women's FA Cup, and I know we talk about it a lot, but actually now it really was ahead of its time, and you had a client and a brand who was willing to, you know, overlook media value, broadcast minutes, for the story and the purpose behind what they wanted to do as a brand and what they wanted to achieve. And I think you continue to see that in the approach of brands, you know, working with Vitality on netball. Yes, Vitality, every property that they look at, you know, the same with working with the ECB on the Vitality Blast. The branding is really important to have out there. They're actually still a relatively new brand, which is hard to believe how well they're known. But, you know, when you look at netball, it's as much about what can we do to help this sport achieve what it wants to achieve. And they started very, very early in that sport, and they've grown with netball, and they've supported them, and they've been able to, fundamentally, they've been able to change the sport by supporting netball in funding, you know, professional contracts. You know, the reason that the Vitality Roses play and are being paid is because of Vitality. So all of those sponsors that we're talking to that are looking at women's sport are looking at it because they have a sense of purpose. Now, that may be that they're looking to try and support women's sport and, you know, get the benefit of saying that we were there and we were supporting, and this is how we're helping a sport and a huge group of passionate fans to be enabled to play that sport, you know, or they're looking at how they can support the individual athletes with the incredible stories that you get from them. You can't underplay that. And again, that's why I think it's really important with the media. So, you know, I think sponsors and brands are looking at this with new eyes. They're looking at the value in terms of what they can get from the story, from the purpose, and what it says about them as a brand ultimately. And, you know, the other thing is to look at the audience as well. you know, the audience is probably the most important thing. Does that audience match an audience that we're trying to reach? And whilst it's wrong for many, I think it's a misnomer to say that women's sport is just for women. You know, that's not true. But it's fair to say that there are sports that women's sport does appeal to women, and there's many brands who are trying to reach women for many years having not marketed their products and brands to women. So you know, that's also what we're seeing is real interest in the growth of the fan base as well.
And just a final question, I guess, to each of you. I mean, and we can't get away from it, but the sort of coronavirus hiatus. What are you doing? What does day to day Georgia? What does a day to day look like now?
Well, it's actually not too strange for me because we would be on time off anyway until mid-April. So from that point of view, we'd just be doing remote training anyway. So obviously not going to the gym is a little bit different, but being able to get out and run, we have 5 running sessions a week and then 4 or 5 gyms as well. So it's just making the best of what home gym equipment we've got and being resourceful around the house with finding things to do, but I'm quite lucky. I've got quite a bit of gym equipment and a spin bike as well. So that's
you haven't got a bowling machine in the hallway.
No, unfortunately, no bowling machine. But I've been doing a little bit of catching outside, playing with the dog, and just keeping active. And I think that's the most important thing. It's quite nice to have a mental switch off and to recharge mentally as well after a long couple of months in Australia. So I'm pretty much at the start of it at the moment. I'm sure in a couple of weeks I'll be chomping at the bit to get back out there, but it's quite nice to be mentally refreshed, spend some time at home, which I don't often do, and just keep ticking over.
And Claire, what about you?
I'm retired now, aren't I? So I'm taking it a bit more leisurely, but to be fair, yeah, I've got some basic weights and stuff like that. I'd go for a run. My knees are a little bit in bits now, so running is probably the last on the list. Normally I'm running away from family members at the moment, just trying to get out of the house. So just bike and gym and whatever. I mean, I don't have a program to follow anymore, so having worked for 6 months, it's actually quite nice to find time to exercise every day because it's kind of what I'm used to. So actually feels quite normal doing what I'm doing at the moment, having quite a lot of the day to do as I please.
And Lisa, what about you? How do you run an agency in a time like this?
Well, do you know what? We're finding new ways every day for the work that we do. We actually rolled out fluid working last year. Someone clearly knew something that I didn't, and actually have a really flexible way of working, so we're pretty well set up. We've got some pitches on underway, and actually, you know, going to be even more important for the start of various different seasons, hopefully towards the end of the year. That's going to be really fascinating, running a pitch and being creative via Zoom. So you know, we're finding our way through. The most important thing more than ever is that we are, you know, finding ways that we can support our clients, give them the space while, you know, their business is going under, you know, through some incredible changes, and also being able to support them creatively with kind of proactive thinking. I think the one thing that we're really finding is, you know, there's been so much content created and there's so many ideas that you could come up with. And we're really lucky to work with brands like Vitality and Under Armour, where, you know, they've got a real role to play in terms of keeping people active, but actually thinking a little bit more in the longer term rather than the short term, because you can come up with an idea at the moment, it'll be done by tomorrow. So that's what we're trying to do. And most importantly is just stay together virtually as much as we can as a team. So we come together once a week as a full team on Zoom for catch-ups and quizzes but every day making sure that we're checking in with everyone, because it's really difficult, you know, working parents with a family at home, those people that care for people as well, as well as, you know, we've got lots of the team that live in their own, and that's equally difficult. So yeah, it's about you know, we've got a really strong family team culture, and it's times like this when that the investment in that over the 35 years it becomes even more important.
Well, listen, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's great to have a chat. And be well, all of you. Hopefully we'll get to the end of this as soon as we can.
You too. Keep up the good work, Richard.
Take care. Thanks, Richard.
Cheers, all.